This podcast is intended for educational purposes only and is not medical or legal advice. Always follow your local policies, procedures, and protocols when functioning in your respective profession. Additionally, the views expressed by the speakers and owners of this podcast are their own and do not represent the views of their respective employers. Listener discretion is advised.
Alert Medic 1, respond.
Ken, Josh, and Mustafa here. Welcome back to the Alert Medic 1 podcast. Okay, well, hey, welcome back, everybody. Today is just going to be a quick shock index. We're just, trying to spitball some ideas and threw out there. Thanks to Aaron from PragMed from attacking this hard on the social medias, but staffing models and EMS. He's been talking pretty hard about dual ALS systems. It centers around a ongoing, I don't know about legal, but policy battle and setup of staffing in a private agency out west. It's a battle between the municipality and the business. I'm not going to name either side, but it has brought to light via Aaron's posts this dual medic staffing. For those that are wondering, what do you mean dual medic? Just simply, you have two ALS providers on a transport unit instead of an EMT and an ALS provider or a variety of other staffing models. And there's a lot of people that have pretty strong opinions on both sides of this. The people that support it tend to say that it doesn't lead to skill degradation, that by having two medics, you're able to have more knowledge on the truck together, that you're able to bounce ideas off each other. But they never seem to address the financial implications of, paying for two ALS providers or sometimes disregarding some of the studies out there that do talk about skill degradation with similarly trained level providers and high acuity calls. So Cody, I'll kick it to you first on what your thought on just in general, the dual ALS, I'll talk about my part, how I feel about it. And then we can talk about different staffing models out there and whether we like them or not, talk about something along those lines. Like I said, guys, this was we're just pulling this topic right now out of thin air just to give, us something to talk about.
Yeah, man, the dual medic thing, it's a little bit difficult for me to kind of pick a side, I guess. I don't want to be the fence sitter on this one, but so I came up in a medic basic system, but we always had the option of requesting additional ALS support if we needed it. The benefit, I can't see one, especially in today's, today's climate of EMS delivery, kind of like what you were talking about, especially with the story that you mentioned. The problem is the problem not enough paramedics, or is the problem not enough ambulances to respond to the calls? If your problem is not enough ambulances to respond to the calls because of your staffing model of dual medic, well, then maybe, perhaps you should reevaluate it. Do you need a medic on every truck? There's another question, right, to debate. Does every response require a paramedic? Yes, no, maybe. I mean, we all have 100 examples that we can give of where, this call came out, BLS looked like nothing, and, showed up there in arrest. Okay, yeah, it happens. It's a known risk, something that you have to deal with. But I think having two medics on scene is helpful. You got a lot of stuff to do, and you don't have a lot of time to do it. Absolutely, man. There's I don't think there's any skill degradation in those cases. It means that there's plenty of skills to go around that need to be done. If the skill that we're talking about, and we talk about skill degradation, you guys correct me if I'm wrong, but we're mostly talking about things like intubation, right?
Innovation, but I think also having the authority to make the decision on what is going on. if say you do a 12 lead and you have that second medic, you may rely on that second medic more to confirm what you're looking at instead of, you know, investigating and getting better with your 12 leads. Yeah. You know, yeah. Does it help to have a second person, a second opinion sometimes? Definitely. I wholeheartedly agree with that. But like if you're constantly leaning on your partner because they're the better EKG interpreter, then stuff like that. And just splitting of tasks. So I describe my part of the skill degradation in that. So without getting into my agency's breakdown right now, every cardiac arrest, we have two ALS providers on at a minimum. And sometimes the way I run it, there's two high acuity, quote unquote, high acuity skills that kind of happen during cardiac arrest, an IO and an intubation. Everything else is meds pushing, and defibrillation. Maybe a pressor is used. Maybe a drip is done later, but the two that are always given is an IO and an intubation, and we'll kind of split it. And if I just happen to be the one that is getting IO all the time, then I'm not getting the intubation, and then vice versa. Not that IO is like something that I think degrades over time, but intubation, yeah, intubation is a skill that can degrade if not used. And I know there's people that, even at busy systems, when they do things like this where they split it up, may go many cardiac arrests without an intubation. So intubation is probably the one everyone thinks about when it comes to skill degradation.
I gotta say though, it depends on the system though, right? Like just pushing back a little bit on this. I hear the you know, the issue of skill degradation, but what I would counter that with is, what problem are we trying to fix here? Right? Are we trying to fix a motivation and complacency issue, or are we trying to fix a system issue? You know what I mean? Go ahead, Cody.
Well, I was gonna say, so that's the perfect, so one of the organizations that I'm with is a perfect example of this, right? Where I fly, and we fly with a nurse, right? So this is to essentially pretty high, you know, not high, well, unless it's me, it's probably not a high level ALS provider, but anyway, no, I digress. But you've got two, you know, advanced credentialed individuals that are working on patients, and skill degradation, yes, does go beyond intubation. Let's say you fly with somebody that's really good with vents. Right. So you kind of lean on them to do the vent stuff all the time. And unless you're, to your point, Moose, unless you are trying to watch and learn and let that individual take the lead on the vent so that you can pick it up, then of course there's a skill degradation problem is there. But I agree with you 100% that is a motivation problem. Yeah. If you sit back and go, I'm not good at XYZ, even my partner is, so I let them do it all the time, you are failing your patient and you're failing the next partner that you're going to ride with.
Yeah. And I would say that's on the individual, not necessarily on the system. Now, if the system's allowing for complacency and is encouraging complacency, then that's a system issue, right? I mean, where I've primarily worked and still work part-time, we used to run dual medic chase vehicles with primarily driver only or driver and, you know, BLS units, for lack of a better term. But I personally don't think that there was that skill degradation was such a big issue, because there wasn't a lot of us too, right? If you have a small group of paramedics, then, you know, there's a higher ratio of skills anyway that everyone can kind of feed, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So that's where I would say that if you've seen an EMS system, you've seen one EMS system. And I don't know if blanket solutions are, you know, the possible. I get it. When I first started, where I work full time, there was a big push for a EMS plan 2020, right? And, I actually got in a pretty heated debate with, one of the medical directors talking about, you know, this, you know, the idea of skill degradation and having too many, you know, advanced life support providers. And I vehemently disagreed with him. Now I kind of see it a little bit clearer, where I see the value in having a small core group of people that can do a particular set of skills, especially when we're in the world of way more advanced skills that are coming around the horizon. Things like, you know, ultrasound, again, is my big thing. But, you know, that's, I think, the perfect example of maybe the risk isn't that high, but the that you have to have a ton of reps, and you have to maintain a ton of reps to be able to, you know, be competent in that. So, yeah, I would
why don't we talk about skill degradation with dual EMTs? Why don't we talk about skill degradation of assessment? Why don't we talk about skills?
Well, that's what I was going to say. Where my skills have been, would have, you know, have diminished, right, as a clinician, because I'm not working full time on a truck, is that exactly. That's where I find my shortcomings the most, the assessment skill. I mean, I can drop a line, right? Whatever. I'd like to think that if I position everyone correctly, I train a ton. Like with VL, I'm decent at a tube, but it's the quick thinking on assessments is where I think I'm lacking. So yeah, that's a good point, Cody.
I can go with you on that to the degree, like, recency of experience is a thing. When was the last time I saw this? When was the last time I did this? And I can get with you on that. That's probably an issue. But let's do this scenario. You've got a dual medic truck in a very rural area, low acuity, low volume.
Yeah.
There's skill degradation happening by virtue of recency of experience.
Yeah. So, to be clear, I don't see the utility. And again, we should probably have Ken chime in on this, because he's probably the only one that's, well, unless either of you have that have functioned for a long time in a dual medic ambulance system, because I haven't. I've only been in a transport, I mean, a chase system. But I wonder what his thoughts would be. But I'm with you. The low volume, though, is an example of how the system has to adjust, right? And how would that system adjust? I would hope you force your people to do a lot more training, because if you're not that busy, then you certainly got time to train.
Yeah.
And you certainly have time to do high, you know, I'm thinking of an agency right now, which I won't name, but I know that the average clinician runs about 50 to 60 true legit transports a year. And in that scenario, what do? They train their asses off, and they know they have to be good. I'm with you.
Because what are Navy SEALs doing when they're not doing a real mission, right?
Yeah.
Training. Yeah. You got a point. I mean, and I think it kind of all in my mind comes back to it's more of a system issue, I think. And that is basically what's being addressed in the whole premise of this talk. Mm-hmm. That is happening out west is that it's a system issue. It's not so much, I think, an individual provider issue in that department, but it's a system issue where, one, there is not, I guess, enough trucks on the road. And then in turn, is there enough qualified people to take those positions? And are we, not we, sorry, is the parties involved not recognizing known solutions that with some adjustments in delivery can yield similar, if not, you know, just basically the same results. And, you know, that's switching to an EMT medic model, you know? It's overall a system. I personally don't,
this is just my opinion, and it depends on the system. But what I feel like is probably one of the better systems in the world of having a shortage of EMTs and paramedics, I don't see why we can't have more BLS staffed ambulances and have single chase trucks. I don't know why that wouldn't work. Because if a paramedic's needed, you just do a switcheroo, the EMT can go to the hospital, and then you just go right back into, like, I'm sure there's plenty of bad issue, negatives to that system that I'm missing, but, like, I don't know.
I think it's actually pretty simple. The question is, what is the asset that the governing body needs?
Mm-hmm. Right?
If the paramedic is the asset, then, well, for the love of Pete, you know, spread that asset out as much as possible, you know, with a good deployment model. If the asset that you need is an ambulance to show up to transport, I think therein lies kind of the hole in the dual medic argument.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
It's if you need transport units, you don't need dual, and that's your problem, then maybe you need to bust up your dual medic trucks.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If a lack of paramedics is your problem, well, maybe you need to bust up those dual medic trucks. I think the answer is.
And I'd argue that a lot of places are hurting for those paramedics, right? Which is why I don't see the point. I truly do not. And again, I say this with a grain of salt because I don't know what I don't know, but I don't see the point of dual ALS transport units. I just don't see the point.
Yeah.
It seems like oversaturation. I do see the point of dual ALS chase trucks, but again, I'm biased because I used to work in that, but I'll be the first one to tell you, I prefer to work by myself. So that's why I like solo trucks.
So,
solo chase truck, sorry.
So one, speaking to like the dual ALS chase, that actually makes a lot of sense because you are still spreading resources while there are transport units that can still facilitate the BLS transport. Mm-hmm. And you don't have to rely on, now you tie those two ALS providers to a transport unit. So that is two ALS providers to one transport, but it could be with a dual ALS chase, two ALS providers to at least a minimum of two transports. And yes, obviously simple math, not trying to insult anyone's intelligence on that. But you definitely are able to spread your resources much better.
And I definitely remember examples of where there'd be two calls that would come out and we only had the one chase truck. So it was known, all right, I'm going there. I'm taking, because the trucks were dual resourced, right? Two of everything. You grab everything and go. And then that second, the paramedic goes solo to a second emergency.
Yep.
Yeah. And I think it goes, you know, again, you can take this another step further with a system argument and maybe stop letting dispatch choose what assets go to the scene. Let the EMTs get to the scene and do their assessments and then decide, okay, I need an ALS upgrade. I need ALS.
Interesting. There's a large jurisdiction that does that right now. In our state, where there'll be, you know, someone will go to the scene and then they will ask, do you need a transport? If so, is it an ALS transport or a BLS transport?
Yeah.
And I'm not saying that's the best, because I will tell you one major blind spot I have is dispatch. As soon as I start hearing whatever echo and cards, I'm like, cool, not, I don't know what I don't know, but I'm with you.
Degradation. If you rely on the paramedics to do all the assessing and all the training and all the stuff, and you render the EMTs basically to nothing more than gophers and ambulance drivers, and the gopher is the, hey, go for the stretcher, go for the bags. You know, that's what a gopher is. But if you relegate them to that role, well, then of course there's skill degradation on the EMT basic side. And guess what? There's going to be times where you're only left with the EMT basics to run the calls.
Mm-hmm.
Guess what? They have no confidence. They have no recency of experience. They haven't put their hands and heads in the game because they've been sitting back watching the medics do it all. And, you know, was it you and I that were talking about how you like to sit back and let the EMTs do their thing before you step up as the medic? Was that you and I that was talking about that?
Possibly.
Right. And there's
my brain's a little fuzzy today. So long night. No, you have a very good point that you have to have a system that is going to benefit all your providers. Whether you purposely do that or not, I'm not sure. Or it's just built into the system. So without sharing too much about my system incorporates a lot of the things we're talking about right now. So we have dual BLS units, and that's the majority of our transport units. We have ALS transport units that are single medic EMT. Every now and then, because of overtime or just staffing in general, there'll be dual ALS, but it is not the standard or even the minimum staffing for those. And that's a very like one-off thing every now and then. Then we have a large chase system between chase cars and suppression pieces. So we do really rely on not only just the BLS units running BLS calls. So they're going to BLS calls and getting that recency, that skill usage, even though some of them probably would argue that there's not a whole lot of skills they're using. But then we also have the ALS call that the BLS units are being involved in, sometimes getting there ahead of us. And then the ALS provider is making that decision, hey, am I going? Am I not? And making yourself available to be better used across the jurisdiction, to be more available for those ALS emergencies. And then on our, what would be like the Echo and Omega calls, you're getting two ALS providers for sure. You know, and that's where those calls that typically there's a lot more to handle, whether it's the scene, skills, patient acuity, whatever it is, you know, so cardiac arrests, couple different MVC dispatches, trouble breathings, unconscious patients, stuff like that, where there's an expectation there's a little bit more going on that needs some more resources thrown at it between both manpower and ALS. And I would argue that we've done a pretty good job of delivering ALS and just EMS care in general in my jurisdiction. I see all the points of like, hey, we need to make sure everyone's taken care of as our providers, but also make sure that the right care is getting the right spot.
I think culturally in EMS, we've overemphasized the paramedic's role in utility and completely underemphasized and underappreciate what the EMTs are actually capable of. And I speak from previous experience in another state in Texas, right? So the EMTs are, you know, they're dropping supraglottic airways. They're doing CPAP. They're doing stuff. They're doing, you know, on the spectrum of, you know, pre-hospital care, relatively basic things that it's hard to screw up. And the funny thing is when you actually sit and look at the evidentiary support for what we do on scene and en route as paramedics that have an actual impact on the outcome, you might be shocked to see it. Like for a stroke patient, for example, when you look at the EMS QA measures, the national measures for what actually impacts the outcome and what an EMS agency is measured, the standard they're measured against, there's two things that are considered evidence-based measures that impact the outcome. And it is a pre-hospital stroke exam and a blood glucose check. That's it. Right. And then get them to the intervention as soon as possible. But there's these systems that turn a CVA call into a big to do. Now, granted, there's airway stuff, there's mental status things to worry about. And I get all of that. But what we're going to do in route actually may negatively impact that outcome. Or the IV sticks, sitting on scene, trying to do an IV on a stroke patient. It's all time wasted. And that's millions of brain cells a minute that you're costing the patient to do ALS stuff that has no mortality benefit.
And, you know, Mike, OKMedic talked about this. He's posted about how the vast majority of our, you know, specifically speaking to strokes, the vast majority of our stroke calls are BLS in nature. Mm-hmm. We do the, as he says, the 18 gauge lock of love and monitor as ALS providers. And the number of those ischemic strokes, because that's the vast majority of strokes that we run, is ischemic strokes, don't progress to a hemorrhagic, don't progress to a patient losing their airway. Can it happen? Yes. Is someone going to listen to this and be like, well, I encountered this one patient that, you know, decompensated so far that we had to do this, this, and this? Yes, it happens. You cannot count out the outliers to these situations. But the vast majority of these can be run BLS, to the point that my agency has a stroke BLS dispatch. Yeah. Do we have a stroke ALS dispatch as well? Yes. Can I tell you the parameters of what makes one over the other? I'm not sure. That's not my wheelhouse. Probably never will be, really.
That's weird.
Yeah, but it can be done. And in those cases, it's, as much as I hate to say this right now, it's all about getting to the hospital as quick as you can. Because yeah, like you said, it's millions of brain cells a minute. And the more time we waste, the more time that patient doesn't have.
And there's absolutely times where gas pedal is still the solution. Yes. Right? It's just now we're realizing that we might have to do a couple things first before we do the gas pedal. But let's not forget what our actual job is, right? Stabilize, make sure we stop harm. And we treat some stuff and then we get them to the hospital. Cody, it's funny. I just pulled up the NEMSQL measures and they've removed the glucose one. Now it's just stroke one, which is assessment, which is even more towards your point.
Yeah. And, you know, I would be remiss if I didn't acknowledge the system of care, right? And the role that EMS does play in that and certain, I would say ALS skills, but we all know that there's jurisdictions in our state that EMTs do the IVs. And which is even there's another support for that argument for, you know, basic stroke calls. But I'd be remiss if I didn't at least acknowledge that, you know, getting that IV en route to the facility if you're going to go straight to CT and stuff like that. Yeah, it's beneficial. There is a time savings there. It shouldn't be more. It's 2 or 3 minutes, maybe. But again, it's millions of brain cells a minute. So as much time, it's just like we were talking about with Dr. Kasem about shaving off as much time and the marginal gains to impact the outcome. Okay, yes, you can make that argument. I just wanted to play devil's advocate with that and acknowledge that, okay, there are some time savings things mm-hmm. that we do that to us pre-hospital are kind of nonsensical, but actually can make a little bit of a big difference once they actually get to the facility. And I would say that that's true for stroke, trauma, STEMI, sepsis, right?
I got a question for you guys just off of that. I've always started at IVs in a moving ambulance, but I've like heard that that's like not cool in some places. Have you guys ever heard of that?
Never heard it as like people dissuade you from doing it. We could talk about the issues with.
I'm just curious because like it's been brought up to me that it could be a safety issue. It could be a X or Y issue, and I'm like, I don't know. Like for the stroke patient. It's risk versus reward, right? That's what we always talk about. And I don't know. I'm okay with starting a line, doing a blood draw, giving it to the hospital, because that's hopefully going to, like you said, marginal gains, right? But yeah, didn't know if you guys had ever heard that, but it was something that that caught me off guard a little bit ago.
I guess you could see the argument from both sides, like just objectively evaluate that and say, okay, yep, there is a safety concern. Jamming, you know, a sharp object in somebody's body, and you know, IVs are not like the Aaron and the Pragmed guys and the vascular guy stuff that they've been doing the last few weeks. It's not a benign, riskless procedure. Mm-hmm. You need to be a little more. I think we as a culture of EMS, we need to be a little bit more deliberate with that decision making, a lot more intentional with it. But if like our state, if we believe that it's, you know, it's okay for EMTs to do it and it's okay for paramedics to do it and things like that, you know, what's okay? Is there really the risk, the big boogie monster, the boogeyman that we're making it out to be? You can argue this both sides and intelligently argue it from both sides.
Yeah, I don't know. The other thing that was interesting, I over the weekend, so we're recording this on the 28th, I went to the National Collegiate EMS Foundation's big conference. And I got to interact with a bunch of, you know, EMTs and folks from across the country. And one state in particular, I want to say it was Virginia's team, Virginia Tech, or I don't know. They would kill me if I didn't know. But they had EMTAs, which is also an interesting thing, right? So obviously we don't have them in Maryland, but certainly they're commonplace around. And the scope that they were describing to me was pretty big in terms of like meds they can give. And I was like, how long is your program? And they're like, 2 semesters. So I'm like, we have a 2-semester BLS program here.
If it was Virginia, that evolved from what was called the enhanced level. Mm. So having volunteered in Virginia back in 2010 and being part of an EMS agency in a way through 2007 and 2010 in Virginia, Tech Rescue, very familiar with them, but enhanced, like it, they had at the time, it was like call dependent or call type. So like in a cardiac arrest, they could push epi, but in other types of calls, they couldn't. I think, anaphylaxis, they could. In 2010, I could drop a King tube as a BLS provider. They could push D50 in a diabetic. You know, just very like off things here and there. I don't think they had any cardiology as an enhanced. I don't know if an advanced in Virginia now does or in that council for those that are interested.
Sounds like the Virginia. CRT, whatever of old, right?
Virginia goes by councils and each council dictates their protocol. So that is the Western, if it was Tech Rescue, that's the Western Virginia EMS Council. And they have some more progressive stuff than I think like Tidewater is another one. There's a Northern Virginia one just because of the propensity of EMS providers in those areas to give.
I want to say these guys were from whatever college they are in Richmond. I want to say that's where they were. I don't know.
So Tech Rescue is obviously Virginia Tech. And then
honestly, I was thinking Technical Rescue, so you had me there. I was like, okay, maybe there's a Technical Rescue team somewhere.
VT
okay,
Rescue, no. Tech okay. Rescue. Having been a student there, it's Tech Rescue to me. Crap, where was I going with this? To give everyone an idea how like far spread providers are in that area, the agency that I volunteered with was the busiest agency in the county. And I think we had 40, maybe 40-ish riding members. Less than 10 were ALS providers. So a lot of the calls were tech completely on a BLS level. And then if you got an ALS provider, you were lucky. So that's the kind of density of providers out there and what that then turns into for protocols for different levels.
I think we need EMTs and helicopters. Dual EMT helicopters.
So the military did it.
Send them. Just throw the patient in there. Send them.
Just prove
go it. That way.
Just do it Philly style, right?
Yeah. Did you lose your train of thought?
See that?
Yeah, and there it goes again.
Second time it happened on here.
Okay.
Yeah. It's okay. Luckily, this stuff edits out silences, so that's good.
Well, I could just take out the complete just staring at the screen, too.
Yeah.
But
honestly, make that a reel and just be like, Cody has a Mitch McConnell moment.
Don't do it. Yeah, you're going to do it.
I think you should.
I'm going to be put right next to old Sleepy Joe.
Oh, please make a meme of that. Please make something. Come on. Not a meme. Like a side-by-side. I don't know.
Well, I'll figure something out at some point.
Oh.
But I think just to wrap up this point here.
I remember what I was going to say.
There okay, go ahead, Cody. There.
Are you running for re-election? Is that... No, sorry. Go ahead.
Well, you know, when you think about and I wanted some ice cream yesterday. Some of this argument can be, I don't want to say answered or can be more, I think we could define it better by how we view or how the governing bodies view EMS. So Matt Zabaski did a great job of this back in the 2014, 2015 of going, okay, if you're a city or county or state official and you see EMS as a transport benefit to the patient only, then yeah, maybe you just need more ambulances and EMTs on the streets. If you see it as, and you see EMS as a clinical and healthcare benefit, that's a value add to the patient's experience. Well, then maybe you need more ALS providers or maybe you don't. I think there's I think answering that question first, in this debate and especially for the governments that we're talking about that are out west that are looking at this and going, what do we need for our citizen? What benefit does this system provide? If it's transport to the hospital, I think I've said this already, right? If it's transport to the hospital, maybe I don't need 900 paramedics working for the system. I do probably need a core handful, for the 10% or 9% or 7% or whatever it is true ALS calls that are part of our patient population. And then the other 90% probably handled by EMT basics. But if we're also, but I would keep those other 897 paramedics in the system and put them more on the front end of the 911 call, right? So if you prevent the emergency, you don't need that many paramedics, right? So I'm talking about community paramedicine type programs. So if you can get in the homes and you can identify the patients that are at risk and you prevent the emergency, you don't need the ED visit. Therefore, you don't need the transport assets.
So I wasn't going to bring this up, but you kind of made me. So I'm reading this book. I'm almost done. It's called Outlive by Peter Attia. Peter Attia is a former surgical oncologist trained in Baltimore. I didn't know that until... listening to the book, who now is like a longevity physician, and I won't go on a diatribe, but basically he talks about the four horsemen that kill everyone, right? That kill the majority of people, and that's cardiac disease, diabetes, type 2 diabetes, cancer, and Alzheimer's. And he talks about how essentially all of them are rooted from metabolic syndrome. And I keep I was listening to it. Long story short, I drove to Kentucky and back for a car part. And my wife and I were listening to it, and I couldn't help but think, I'm like, damn, we keep an EMS, especially in Maryland, we're talking about, like, how can we improve the cardiac arrest survival rate? How can we improve stroke times? And I'm like, wait a minute. Are we falling victim to thinking that since we have a hammer, everything's a nail, right? Are we thinking about everything as a EMS and emergency medicine problem when we really shouldn't be? Like, even with community paramedicine, we're approaching it from the guise of the goggles of EMS, right? Like, how we would treat it as EMS, and we look at high risk. At what point do we, as EMS, and I don't know what this looks like, but at what point should we be, or how can we address that STEMI 30 years earlier when it's just a calcium deposit, right? How do we address that? Like, how can we do that? And I know that we would talk for hours on this, but if you would ask me what I've been thinking about in the past week, that's what I've been thinking about. And yes, I know it's public health. And yes, I know there's no resources. And yes, I know there's whole social determinants of health that really screw a lot of our patients over anyway. But I don't know. I think if we were to look at EMS in the next decade, a couple of decades, we're going to have to address that. We might have hit the peak. I mean, yes, there's going to be marginal gains and marginal improvements in research and techniques and stuff. But at what point do we address the front end and finance that front end so that we don't get the back end? Yeah, I would certainly recommend the book. Like I said, Peter Attia, it's called Outlive, and he describes like health 2.0 being like the old model versus health 3.0. But yeah, I'll give it to you guys. What are your thoughts?
Go for it, buddy.
So to look at it from the EMS perspective, I think we're seeing these, I don't want to bring it up too much, but people leaving the profession, determining what we need to do to retain them. And this is not just talking about paramedics. This is all levels. EMTs, both basics, advanced, and paramedics. All three levels. People are leaving the profession for whatever reason. And we need to identify why they're leaving and what it is that we need to keep them. Because just like you said, that calcium deposit that we could maybe catch 30 years earlier becomes that STEMI. Well, the people leaving and or getting imbued with bad habits or qualities are then leading to worser things in the end. And what can we do to try and fix that now? Because like we're calling attention to it. I think it's pretty well being called attention that there are issues in EMS with toxic workplaces, toxic mentalities, this burnout and saltiness that is going around that's pervasive through the job right now for a variety of reasons, and many of them legitimate, honestly. It's been a tough 4 years with COVID. I think we can all agree to that. Just everything that's happened, both socially, within the job, economically, the world is a crazy place right now. And that just translates into how we do our job. So what do we do to make things better so that in, I'm just going to say 10 years, we have the providers that we have now still in the job and are satisfied with the job and not looking to leave or doing less than ideal things while still in the job. And I think a lot of it harkens to organizations that should be advocating for us more in the right ways and not just trying to push their own agenda. And maybe even looking at it from, you know, should we finally have a, as much as I don't want the federal government involved in everything, the federal government having an actual agency that handles EMS. No. Yeah, I know. We need our libertarian here to just be like, no, but I don't blame them at the same time, you know, but like, you know, if you're in an agency that is the stepchild to a bigger agency, that's a stepchild to an even bigger agency, what do we get in the end? You know, we kind of get the hand-me-downs of the hand-me-downs of the hand-me-downs of just, I'm not saying equipment or anything like that, but just the attention.
So Josh, for me to, just so I understand, I guess what you're saying is we kind of need to fix our own house, right? And get our own things in order for our own clinicians so that we can potentially serve in these different capacities that I was talking about. Is that correct?
Yeah. Yeah. And that kind of does speak to what you were talking about, how it's not on so much the health system. Yes, the health system is involved. The healthcare system is involved in, once again, that that calcium deposit becoming a STEMI 30 years later. The healthcare system is involved, but it takes ownership of your own stuff in your own house to know, like, hey, I need to fix things on my own end, because the government, the healthcare system, the outside external influences are not the be-all end-all solution to it all.
Mm-hmm.
We see it time and time again with many different things in life. If we don't have the personal motivation and drive to fix ourselves, all these external factors can mean nothing, because if we don't follow through on it, we don't have the mentality, we don't have the drive to take these things and live a good life, create a good life, create a great job, atmosphere, attitude, whatever it is, it's all for naught.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, I guess that's why I try, me personally, to have a good attitude about this, even when I know there's stuff within the job it's tough. I acknowledge that not everything's perfect, but hey, if I come in with a smiling face and try and explain things and try and not even rationalize, but put things in perspective for myself and for others, hopefully those people will be like, hey, there are people that still love this job. And if we're fixing ourselves and keeping ourselves positive, then it gives us drive to push nationally, federally, and get things changed. I mean, if we're talking about federal level, I think one thing that would majorly change this profession, a reworking of the Medicare schedule when it comes to reimbursement. Because if the small agencies, like, you know, I work for a big agency, you know, yes, county budgets can always be cut. But the small agencies would greatly benefit from a Medicare schedule adjustment where they're getting more money back from insurance to better pay their people, buy better equipment, house them in better buildings, whatever it is. You know, and if we can do that, then that gives the individual the more motivation to stick around and fix things on an individual and maybe like the next tier up level.
Hey, Cody, your recording just stopped, bud, just so you know. Yeah, so that same thing used to happen to me. That means that your internet connection's a little slow. What a temporizing measure, though, is if you clear your cookies and you clear your if you have other things running or anything like that, and then go from there. No, but I mean, just to kind of catch up on what you were saying, no, I'm with you, man. It is interesting. Who did we just have that conversation with? The jujitsu guy. What's his name?
Bill Dungy.
Yeah. Remember, he was talking about, like, you know, we can't, you know, attracting the 1%, right? But we also have to create an environment where the 1% wants to come. You know? Yeah. Yeah, you're not recording, bud, but you can say what you're saying and I can restate it like it's mine. No, I'm kidding. All right. While you do that, restart your browser. Exactly. Yeah. And I'm just reading what it's telling me. Restart the browser, free some hard disk space, which is probably not a problem because it's a new computer. So I would just clear your cookies and stuff like that. Yep. You're the one that bought a Mac, boss. I'm just saying. Yeah. Or you might have to pray to Jobs to get your access back. Yeah. Josh, are you still there?
Yeah, I just turned off my video. I know I'm going to take this out, but I'm eating
the rest of my food. Fair enough.
You know, I just realized this. Well, this is potato ham soup. And it's cold now. I have no problem with it because I've eaten extremely similar textured materials for like the past 10 years from MREs.
Mm, yeah.
I'm like, it still tastes good. It's just cold.
Yeah, I, Ash made, chicken, what's it called? Either chicken tortilla soup or chicken enchilada soup or
chicken tortilla soup. Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's so good. She made it. She makes it like we have a rotation of stuff. All right, let's see if you're recording. Cody, you are recording now, buddy.
Yep.
Did you figure your idea out?
No, I.
Also, since we're going to edit this out, I just want to say, can you tell PHI to pay for better internet? Like, what the hell? Like,
Yeah, I'm up in the hangar.
Oh.
So it is what it is. I guess I can move over to the weight bench and
let your computer upload. I'm sure your upload might not be at 99% right now.
Yeah, it's at 34.
Yeah, 40, you just got to let it sit.
It was sitting at 85, though. But yeah, all right, go ahead, Cody.
Well, I missed a little bit of the last little bit of the conversation, but I still stick to, I still go back to the recruiting piece of it. And I saw this quote recently, maybe it was last night. There's a lot of wannabe matadors out there, but once they face the bull, they find out that all they wanted to do was dress up and hear the crowd roar. So we have a lot of people in the industry that shouldn't be here. And that's what Bill, you know, this is something that Bill was talking about from the 6 feet episode, that there's a lot of folks that shouldn't be here. I just saw this on LinkedIn. Have you guys seen this post? It's by Orlando Rivera.
Was it the people standing in front of the ambulance?
Yeah, it's the unvarnished truth about becoming a paramedic. It's not for
the front paramedic looks like an alien.
Yeah.
Okay.
And it talks about, you know, this, the unspoken realities and why you need to think twice about coming here. Like, there's nothing that drives me up the wall faster and could really, it could hijack my mood if I let it, than listening to folks complain about how hard they're working. Right? How many calls we had to do, and this was stupid, and that was stupid. It's like, what the fuck do you think it was going to be? What did you think this was going to be like? What did you sign up to do? Why are you here? And I think a lot of folks that get into this industry are not really clear on their why. Right? They were asked their whole lives, and this, I think this is where our society kind of fails us a little bit, just as individuals, where you spend your whole childhood growing up hearing, what do you want to be when you grow up? What do you want to be when you grow up? What do you want to be when you grow up? And let's change the question. Change one word. Who do you want to be when you grow up? And then you go find a living that allows you to be that individual, that allows you to be him or her. And you make your living being who you want to be, instead of, I'm too cheap to go to medical school. I'm too good to flip burgers. EMT, a paramedic. That's what I want to do. You know, it's nuts. It's nuts. And these realities that he talks about in this post, number one, the stress is unimaginable. Life and death situations on a daily basis, dealing with the rawest forms of human vulnerability. That is not for everyone. It is not. I love this phrase, think you're tough, the job will test that theory to its breaking point. You know, everybody wants to be a hero until it's 2 o'clock in the morning and you haven't slept all day. Right.
Yeah.
There's the finances piece of it, which we've talked about. You know, it's a well-known issue. You're not going to get rich doing this job. You should know that by now coming into it, and maybe make a different decision if you want to get paid, to do this. But here's why it might be exactly what you want to do. It's more than a job. It's a calling. This is what some of the other things that Bill was talking about. You know, for those who are called to do this job, the calling is all they need. And there are so few people in a department that you can actually see that that's why they're there. Right. They're called to do it. They're the ones that are going to pick up, you know, the broken glass and stuff like that in the homes. And after somebody's ransacked it, they're the ones that are doing that extra mile because they care about the person. I can't say that I'm always that person, you know. The modest pay is a testament to the fact that you're driven by passion, not material gain. The job is enough. The job is enough, and it has to be enough sometimes. Again, if you want to get rich, you either have to work 9 jobs to get 9 EMS jobs to get rich doing it, or you're going to have to go on and do something else. And the irregular, I love this one. The irregular hours mean you're living a life less ordinary. Yes, you could start drinking at noon on a Wednesday. Isn't it awesome? But anyway, you guys should check this out on LinkedIn. It was posted by, and read it for yourselves, by Orlando Rivera.
You know, we posted about this, was it a week or two ago? Simple little meme.
Yeah.
That this job is not about us. It's not about cool calls and cool interventions and doing all these, you know, saving lives. It's about the people we take care of, regardless of what it is. You know, yesterday I ran 12 in 24 hours, and the majority of them were either BLS or just barely ALS. And some of them just, you know, that's what it was. It's about the people. They called for us. We showed up. We helped them out, and we got them to the hospital. We did what we needed to do to help them out and be that helping hand in the moment. Was it frustrating sometimes? Yes. I'm not going to say, you know, there's no one out there that's angelic, idyllic, yeah, whatever it is, in every moment of every call. Just yeah.
Every time.
I get this morning, I don't know what time, 3 o'clock in the morning, I'm up and I'm like, why am I up? This sucks. But at the same time, like, hey, I'm here. This is my job. This is what I'm here to do. Let's do this. Let's take care of you. Let's go to the hospital. Let's do what you need to do.
You know,
and it's about them. Plain and simple.
What a privilege that is. Right, guys? What a privilege it is to be that person, that individual whom has no other, in their minds, they have nowhere else to turn, nowhere else to go. They don't know what else to do. What a privilege it is to be the person that gets to show up and help that person navigate the worst day of their lives, right? What a privilege that is. And I have to keep this very, very, very uppermost in my mind when I'm on duty, either on the aircraft or on the ground, and have to go, look, man, to repeat what you just said, Josh, ain't about you. You exist for them. This job exists for them. It doesn't exist to give you this wonderful feeling of satisfaction and to drive a Maserati. It's not what it's here for. It's
and real quick
service.
You will have those feelings.
Yeah.
It's okay to have, you will get those feelings of, this is amazing. This is an amazing job. It truly is.
Yep.
So don't forget that.
Yeah. I mean, you live for those moments of after a call, like we talked about before we started recording. You know, we're 30 seconds out of the door of the ER when we're done with that call. We're laughing. Now, of course, I mean, there's some dark humor involved. What? I mean, you're laughing. You're like, man, this is, yeah, that's what I signed up for. This is what I signed up to do. And you have to, yeah, man, you have to cherish those moments when they happen. But also, I would challenge myself, and I would challenge everybody else that's doing this job, to look for those moments in every call. Look for the satisfaction. If Tony Robbins talks about this. You know, you develop a belief about something, and then you start looking for reasons and items to support it, to support your belief. So if you go to a call thinking this is bullshit, you will show up with the mindset of, I'm going to prove this is bullshit and I don't need to be here. You know, instead of, you know, these are all serious, you know, this is a serious call until proven otherwise.
And I'll tell you what, that's a huge point you just made right there, buddy, because once you get to that point, what you just described, it's not that far off. You're not too far from just throwing somebody on the cot face down and then getting on the news. You know what I mean? You're not too, once you have that level of apathy, you're not that far off. I'll say this, though, I mean, and I agree with most of what you guys are saying, right? The thing is, though, I think there's a situation where we can have both. We can make it so that people aren't making $15 an hour as a paramedic.
Yes.
Right. You know what I mean? We can have both. And certainly I don't, at least I'm not supporting the idea that, you know, we shouldn't be asking for more money. We shouldn't be asking for better working conditions. We should, you know what I mean? No, absolutely we should. Because what I don't want is a bunch of self-sacrificing paramedics burning themselves out.
Right.
You know what I mean? And I don't think you guys are saying that either. The idea is you guys are pushing against the entitlement that we sometimes see, right? Yep. I mean, if you want to, you can always go get another job, right? That doesn't mean that you don't deserve a very good, you know, living wage, and that you deserve your mental health to be okay. You deserve all the support that you need, right? But at the same time, if you're getting all those things in a good situation, the fact of the matter is you're still going to have bad days. kind of like what Josh was talking about. You're still going to have bad days. You're still going to have those thoughts, but it's in those moments where it's up to you to take care of yourself, for, you know what I mean, for your mental health and all that, so that you're not getting to the point where you're becoming apathetic and throwing people face down on a stretcher.
Yeah. And I'll take all that idealistic nonsense that I just spewed out there, and I will put it squarely on us as individuals that you should show up with the right attitude, but I will punt the majority of the problems up to the organizational leadership culture of EMS. And you know what? If you want recruiting, you want retention, you want engagement, you as a leader are responsible for building the environment where those things are possible. Mm-hmm. It doesn't just happen because you throw your badge on somebody or throw your patch on somebody and say, blam, retention, engagement, all these things that matter. And you're going, man, I don't know how tall you are because I never see you standing up.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that was John Salka at the Texas the Teaks Leadership Symposium said, you ever know how you got a bad boss? You never see him standing up. Right. You as leaders at the top level. Now I'm going somewhere with this. At the top level, you have to build the environment for the results that you're looking for to even be possible. Right. And that's not hot dogs, and it's not grilling burgers every Friday, and it's not ordering pizza.
Certainly not pizza. Yep.
It's not going to get it. It's actually listening and addressing the issues. And this could be a whole nother. This is another 2 hours of things. However, if you're the guy that, and I'm going back to the individual now, because leadership is also your responsibility too. You have to lead yourself, meaning that if the organization tells you to wear a certain kind of shirt and a certain kind of socks and underwear, you have a responsibility to get inside those, what the organization says, what we expected you. You have a responsibility to meet those expectations. You can't rail against the leadership and be a rebel and then expect that organization to invest a lot of time in your and a lot of time and effort and money into keeping you. Right? Retention is also your responsibility as an employee and as a member of a department. It's also your responsibility. You know what? Say, hey, no, I'm worthy of this investment. Not because I just showed up. That's an entitlement. I showed up today and I'm entitled to all these things that make my life great. No, that's entitlement. I'm talking about doing your part well. Just because you have a shit leadership structure or you were handed a bad deal from as a department, it doesn't get you off the hook for being a good dude. Doesn't get you off the hook for being a good teammate. Doesn't get you off the hook for being a good employee. I mean, that's how you find that there's some middle ground here that we all need to try to get to, right? The organization leadership needs to come one way and the team needs to come the other way. And you got to meet in the middle or these problems will persist. It just will. The cultural issues in EMS they'll persist. And there's no easy answer to it either. Right. That's a shitty way to end that whole diatribe of the nonsense.
I'm okay with starting with Maserati, so I'll be the first victim.
Right. But then again, are you going to drive a Maserati into some of those parking lots?
If it's not mine, I will. This was good. This was good.
It was a good talk. Hope listening to this short little hour, Shock Index gives you something to think about, staffing models, mentality. Just think about EMS in general overall.
And if you disagree with us, you should let us know.
Yeah.
Because we want to hear from you.
Yeah.
Even if we don't agree with you.
You guys know where to reach us. Primarily Instagram. Hit us up in the DMs. And we'll get back to you. And, you know, we'll have a debate. We'll talk about it. We'll agree on things. We'll disagree. Whatever you want to talk about. So
if you make a good argument, we might even have you on the show. But it's got to be really good. It's got to get past the screening of Josh and Cody. So it's got to be good.
But for all the listeners out there, thanks for listening. If you're not already, make sure to follow us on Instagram, Facebook. Got a episode coming out every week for a while. Listening for some stuff. It's some good content. But once again, thanks for listening. Wherever you are, Be safe. See you.
Good.